Hello, welcome to the Bitter End Podcast with me, Tom Denny.
Me, Todd Jordan. Thank you, Tom, for taking over the drum roll there. And we are here to watch Police Academy 2,
their first assignment. Yeah, from 1985, 1 year after the original.
Wow, man, because the original was such a slam dunk.
I think it was. I think that, I think it really, outperformed more than anyone was expecting it to against some other big hitters from 1984. So they're like, fuck, get Gutenberg and the gang back in there, let's make some more money. We're gonna send them on their first assignment.
And from the trailer, it looks like they're all pretty much back, right? We've got Mahoney,
mm-hmm.
Gootsy Collins himself.
Yep.
We've got Hightower.
Yep, we've got Tackleberry.
We've got your boy Tackleberry. We've got Jones, the villain of the piece, a.k.a. Michael Winslow.
Yeah.
We've got Hooks.
Hooks is back. Loving Hooks.
We've got Lassard.
Lassard is in there. There's also, it seems like Spackler, the kind of clumsy guy, is back. Didn't spot Georges Martin.
No, which is weird because he was with... What was the name of the lady?
Yeah, the really tough, lady instructor. So she might not be in it, and we might not have
Kim Cattrall either.
Doesn't look like Kim Cattrall is in there. She obviously had far better things to do with her life. And it also looks like Harris isn't in there. So we've got some different kind of looking...
Harris being gone makes sense because they're not at the academy anymore. They're in the real world, right? We do have the trailer kind of gives you your rundown of all your gang. And he's like, including, all of these names that Todd and Tom just mentioned. And Commandant Lassard and Captain Lassard. Now, are they the same guy?
Are they related?
I don't know. Is it... What's going on
is
here?
Is this just very poor script writing? That they just gave the guy, the same name?
One's spelt with two S's, one's spelt with one.
Of course.
But other than that, I mean, it's the same old shit, second movie in.
Yeah, so we've got, I think, the Harris character, this is going to be Mauser.
Mauser! Oh, it's such a good name!
It's a good name. Other than that, any strong impressions from this trailer, buddy?
The Michael Winslow bit of the trailer was the absolute worst bit of the trailer. It was him doing some hilarious comedy kung fu fighting with sound effects.
I think that this is a big part of Michael Winslow's character going forward in these, that he's does kung fu and puts on a Karate Kid style bandana. We can only wait and see how tedious this may or may not become.
Yeah, I think I can do without that. I was liking the, what was the clumsy guy with the wife? What's his name?
Spackler.
I was liking his kind of, he's got a real slapstick shtick that's kind of coming through in this, a lot of him accidentally hitting people in the head with shit. I can get down with that.
Yeah, they might have blown Hooks's main moment from the film, because obviously she's the one that talks in talks like Michael Jackson. And then she'll, every film, go loud at one point, and they kind of showed that in this trailer.
Yeah,
every film she's gonna go, "Freeze, dirtbag!"
Yeah,
and everyone will go "Oh, out of character," but we've already kind of seen that now.
So I'm wondering if they've blown their wad by putting the gang straight onto the street, right, straight away for the second movie, because we know from the first movie that the process is at least a year, right? It's 14 months, I think, that they have to spend in Police Academy. Now, we saw them graduate at the end of the first movie.
Yeah.
But could they not have dragged it out, just not done the graduation bit, and do a Harry Potter, where it's okay, the second movie is the second bit of it?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we know that the creator of Police Academy wanted it to be a 10-movie series, but maybe at the time they didn't know if they would get a sequel or not, so they kind of want... You have to have that bit of closure. And the third one is back in training.
Okay.
They're obviously going back. They're going to... So I wonder if this one's going to be a bit of a be a bit of a stinker. And then they'll be like, oh, I better go back to formula. I've got to get Harris back. Well, is it going to be a stinker? This seems like a great opportunity for us to play the IMDb guessing game.
Hit me with that game. I love that game, baby.
Okay, so Todd has seen the trailer. He now must guess what this film has been rated on IMDb. So, Police Academy 1 from 1984 got a 6.7.
That's unbelievable.
It's quite 6.7. High, isn't it? So, Police Academy 2, their first assignment, 1985. What do you reckon?
5.8.
Mate, you're really close on these. 5.6.
Oh!
So it's a drop of 1.1.
Can they keep that up every movie?
Ooh, I don't
know. They almost could.
Yeah, they could. So it could be like, is it going to be a slow decline? Has the rot started to set in?
I do feel that the trajectory of this franchise is going to be a pleasant, slow slope down. It's going to be interesting, though, because I talked a little bit on the last episode about how I believe comedy and horror are related in that it's not just the story that matters with the film. It's got to give you this sort of physical reaction of, like, you've got to laugh or you've got to be scared, you know, as well as the movie being, the story being good.
Yeah.
One place I think that they're going to differ, though, is that me and my buddy Tom can sit down and have a great old time laughing at a really bad horror film. Like, there's a definite, like, it's a U-shaped curve in that an amazing horror film gives a lot of enjoyment.
Mm.
A really shit horror film gives a lot of enjoyment. And there's a big dip in the middle.
Yeah.
Comedy is not going to work the same way.
No, it's
and
not.
And the worse it gets, the worse it's going to get.
Yeah, that
there's
is
no,
true.
You can't enjoy a bad comedy, even ironically.
Yeah, that is difficult. And it doesn't have like an opposite effect, like the worse a comedy gets, the more scary it gets. It's not it's not like, it doesn't sync up with your horror analogy, like in that sense. So yeah, it could get a little bit dark by the end of this season, but we will have to wait and see.
I don't think this one's going to be a dark one, though. I'm peppy.
I think it'll be all right. It's going to be all right. Should we go find out how they do?
Let's go rub our noses in it. It was all right, I suppose. Now, I think I warmed to it a bit more than you, Tom. And
yeah,
listeners
so.
At home, just to give you a tiny bit of backstory, this is the way that this shit went down. We watched the first half of this movie. We were kind of like, where's the jokes? Where's the fucking jokes,
They were
guys?
Not Fast and Furious. They were not forthcoming.
Yeah. Goots. Gutenberg. Gutenbergler. Gootsy Collins. Where's the jokes? Bring them jokes. We weren't having a good time. Then we paused it, ate something, came back, and I kind of laughed my ass off. So I wonder if
point, yeah.
either it's a movie of two halves, of which the second one is better, or I'm just more inclined to chuckle after I've had something to eat.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think there is something to say about it. Like, there's a definite shift in the film. Where it suddenly goes, and now here's a little bit of story. And we're going to give, like, Steve Guttenberg something to do, and some things actually kind of happen.
Well, here's the thing. There's so many people in this movie, and very little of them have anything to do.
Oh, God, like, Hooks does absolutely fuck all in this. She has nothing to do. Like
Hightower barely does anything. He just walks around. Most of Hightower's like antics happen off screen.
Yeah, it's like Hightower walks into a room and then people are beaten up off screen, and then he comes out and goes like, well, I'll beat them all up.
Yeah, and then Tackleberry, like that beautiful psychopath you love, he has a romance storyline, which is all about him going on dates and stuff. You don't really get to see him, except for a memorable bit at the beginning.
Yeah.
You don't really get to see him, like, brutalize anybody or do any of the, like, awesome Tackleberry shit.
Yeah, he's not in it, like, a whole heap, is he? For, like, somebody who was one of, like, the bigger presences in the last film. So, like, I guess it's a bit more solidly Gutenberg-y.
Yeah, they're establishing him as the poor man's Tom Hanks that he is.
Yeah, and he kind of turns around from halfway through, but it's just not... it's a different director and different writers to the first one, and I'm just going to say, it's not very funny. It's just not funny, and it's... The editing in it is also, it's really choppy as a film. It's quite jarring. Like, scenes end abruptly and jump into the next scene, like a weird breakneck pace. And, like, scenes will finish and you go, like, oh, was that a gag?
Was it
developing
not?
Character? Yeah. What was... So, we should probably start from the top.
Yeah. Wind it back, Sunshine. Set it up. You set it up, they'll knock it down.
And it's, we get another, so the beginning film, started with, a little caption to set the scene. So the first one was, the radical Lady Mayor shaking things up.
Love that Lady Mayor.
And in this one, it's just saying that, that it's a mean street out there, but the class of 84 Police Academy are ready to go on their first assignment, but is the world ready for them? Okay, fine, fair enough. And then we've got this little... kind of like dorky dude.
His name's Sweet Chuck.
So I think he becomes one of the cops later on, but in this he's a civilian.
He's running a shop that sells lampshades and chandeliers.
Yeah, in a very rough neighbourhood. Or you get the impression that maybe the city has become quite lawless. Like, it's a dangerous place to live. Especially if you're like a diminutive chandelier proprietor.
A chandelier.
A lampshaderoo. So it's a bit like the first film that kind of sets the tone in a not straight comedic way. So the first one you had Tackleberry going a little bit diehard, stalking around this office building. And this, you've got this guy really fortifying his shop when he's about to leave.
Puts up a Clint Eastwood standee in the window to scare people away.
He's got electrified barbed wire. He's got a bear trap by the back door and all this kind of shit.
And then he fucks it all up by walking out onto the street, presumably at midnight or whatever, and going to this weird telephone banking machine, which it's a bit like an ATM, but it's got a
telephone on it.
And it
says hello to you continuously.
Yeah, hello. And he's he can't get it to work. He's talking on the phone to the machine. And who should rock up behind him other than Bobcat Goldthwait?
Yeah, so Bobcat Goldthwait is... he's a bit more of a mainstay, I think. He's going to be in a few more of these films to come.
Now, unless you've never heard the name Bobcat Goldthwait, he is the man whose voice sounds a little bit like this.
Yeah, he's got wild, crazy hair, and he goes,
thank you very much!
And that is his entire shtick, because... before, I thought he was going to be in this film, and so I was trying to watch some of his stand-up on YouTube. I don't know if it hasn't aged well or it was just never funny, but his brand of comedy is shouting. And I think early in his career, his whole thing was that he just said, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
But he shows up and harasses Sweet Chuck, and we get the impression he is a gang leader of a ragtag bunch of punks, the way that punks can only look in 80s films.
The gang are called the Stullions, I think,
not even the Stallions.
No, it's not the Stallions, it's the Stullions. I'm pretty sure that's it, because there's a joke later about Gutenberg getting them confused with scallions, and they're like, no, it's not scallions, it's stullions.
Yeah.
Bobcat's name as the leader of the gang is Zed.
And then we just kind of cut away from that, and then we get to see what the guys from Police Academy 1 are up to.
So they've all graduated.
They're all out there working in the field. None of them is really doing anything super amazing. You kind of get the impression they're kind of graduating. They're just doing kind of shit jobs. So Tackleberry is working as basically a school crossing guard or something.
Yeah, we get a great little scene with him where there's a mother with her. She's taking her son to school, and he is, I believe, Kevin's older brother from The Wonder Years as like a young little boy in this. And he's a right pissy little brat, doesn't want to go to school. And the mum goes up to Tackleberry the Crossing Guard and is like, my son doesn't want to go to school. Could you give him a scare for me? Which is a terrifying thing to like just comprehend of like this woman walk up, any stranger in a uniform and be like, can you terrify my son for me?
Little does she know it's Tackleberry that she's asked. And
so what he does is fire a flare gun into the backseat of the car.
Like shatters the glass, fills the car with smoke. The kid like freaks the fuck out and gets out. And the mum just turns around and goes, yeah, thanks.
Thanks, officer. That was exactly what I had in mind.
Oh, I couldn't have done it, but I was... If it had been tear gas, that would have been maybe a little bit better, but thank you. I think we get a scene of Michael Winslow doing something, and it was tedious.
Oh, we get this really weird... He's not even on patrol. So Michael Winslow is...
Oh, he's at
Jones,
a cafe.
He's a sound effects guy. And this, like... Obviously, in 1984, like, yuppies were a big concern, more so than they are now. But we get this kind of yuppie couple... Who we know that they're yuppies because they've got sweaters tied around their necks.
Yes.
And they're both bragging to each other about how they don't own a television.
It's really no better than television.
I wouldn't know. I never watch television.
Personally, I don't even own a television.
Yeah. That's it. Like, oh my God, such awful people.
Just the worst.
Tom, can you comprehend hating anyone more than you would hate someone that didn't own a television?
No, not really.
That is the lowest form of humanity.
Oh, hanging's too good for him.
Yeah, exactly. And Michael Winslow agrees with you, obviously. Yep. And so he really gives them what for.
He gives them
the
business.
What they deserve, which is that while they're eating on this date, he makes some like unflattering sound effects about them eating, like to make it so like when the lady takes a bite of her sandwich, he's all like, nom, 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 nom.
Hungry, Diane.
And the couple are too stupid, because they don't own TVs, I guess they're not educated.
Yeah.
They're too stupid to know that this sound they're hearing is literally being made by this man sat next to them in the cafe.
Yeah, because when you eat, you can tell that like any sounds from eating are actually coming from literally inside your own body, inside your head. But they do not get this. And this is the fundamental flaw with all of Michael Winslow's shit in this film. That nobody has any concept of the direction of sound.
Yes.
And it will continue like this throughout the film and I assume throughout the series.
I'm getting a little bit twitchy about Winslow in general.
I was really hoping that it would turn around, but like... It doesn't in this film. Like, I was hoping there would be a point where I'd go like, good one, Winslow. You've made me chuckle. But, yeah. No, it hasn't happened yet. And then we get to see our man, Gutenberg. The Glutenbergler himself. He is just being the most Gutenberg-y Gutenberg he can be. He's working as a beach cop.
Is a beach cop actually a thing?
No, I think that's more kind of like, he's basically doing the job of a lifeguard. He's basically being like David Hasselhoff from Baywatch. He's riding along the beach. He's got like cut off police uniforms. He's got like no sleeves and like cut off trouser shorts. And he's just rolling with the boombox on the back of this quad bike. Just being like, hey, everybody, I'm Steve Gutenberg. Hey, what's going on? And then there's a little gag, and I like that.
Well, there's some topless ladies who are like, oh, it's Gutenberger, and he's like, hey, women, wham, wham, wazzle.
Yeah.
He's just like, he's very tiresome, very 80s, very, very Gutenberger. And then these douchebags in like a Jeep kind of come tearing up the beach. They're driving a proper car on the beach. And they nearly run over the topless babes.
Gutenberg's not going to stand for that.
Like, they literally nearly murdered them because they're driving
this
car.
They nearly murdered, like, countless people.
Well, a bunch of dudes with beach balls, but more importantly, the topless babes.
Yeah.
And so Gutenberg goes up to them, turns out he knows them, and they're like, hey, the Goots, how's your glutes?
Yeah.
And he's like, well, you know me, I'm just talking to the topless babes. Hey, by the way, some like total douchebag dingus bro was driving a car on the beach. You seen him? And the guy's like, I ain't seen him. And he's like, wait a minute, it's you. How about you like totally
don't do that.
And the guy's like, no. And then he just like drives along the beach and then basically drives into a marina.
He literally drives off a cliff into the water. And Gutenberg's like, another job well done.
Yep. At which point me and Todd just kind of sit there and go, pretty sure I'd laughed by this point in the first one, but let's see what the next one's going to hold. And so we then cut to the police station.
We get our exposition.
All the stakes in the film are basically laid out, like, super early. It's very nice and neat and tidy, and I did appreciate it. So you've got... you had Lessard from the first film.
Commandant Lessard.
Yes. We've got Captain Lessard, his baby brother, who is running a police precinct, and he gets a telling off from, I think, one of the high ranking officers from the first film, the one who's like, everybody had Johnsons. He shows up and is like, you guys have got like the worst precinct in the city. The Lady Mayor is not happy about this. If you don't sort this out in 30 days, you're fired. You can have 6 new recruits from the police academy. And then we get Mauser, who's like the Harris villain of the piece. He's like the second in command here, and he wants to be the captain. So he like makes a deal that like if Lessard fucks up in 30 days, he's going to be the captain. And you're like, fuck, that was quick. Just like everything you need to know about this film, done. Super quick. I like that baby Lessard has a big picture of his big brother hanging up in his office. I think that's just quite sweet.
I think that's absolutely adorable. And what else is adorable is that when he phones his brother to be like, I need some recruits, neither of them recognize each other's voices at all. He's like, hello, am I speaking to Captain Lessard? Yes, this is Captain Lessard who's speaking. It's your little brother. You remember me, Eric?
Yeah. Weird. I wonder what recruits are going to get sent over.
Well, I can tell you, we get the Glutmeister. Mm. We get big old badass Hightower.
Yep.
We get Spackler, the clumsy married man who's all slapstick. We get Jones, a.k.a. Snoozefest Winslow.
Yeah, fuck off, Winnow.
We get Tackleberry, a.k.a. Tom's favourite.
Yep.
And we get Hooks, the squeaky-voiced Michael Jackson lady.
A.k.a. Todd's favourite.
Oh, yeah!
Well, it was a bad run for Todd in this film because she shows up and then does... They just give her nothing to do.
Well, this is kind of explained in the plot, not in a nice way, but like, so Mauser is in charge of them and he wants them to fail because so that he can become captain. So he gives them all really shit jobs. And one of the jobs that when he gets to Hooks, Hooks is like, am I going to get a police car? And he's like, no, you're not. You're sitting on a desk and you're running the radio. Because he's put her on the radio because she's got a shit voice because he wants it all to fuck up. Which kind of makes sense in terms of like a plot and like how he'll try to sabotage things. But it's just a waste of a banging character, man, because we never see her for the rest of the movie, pretty much, until right at the end.
Yeah, no, they really give her very little to do. And then, like, so the rest of the gang all get kind of, like, divvied up with...
They get partners.
They get, like, sort of, like, partners who've had a little bit more of a long run on the force, and they all kind of just go out into the field. This is the bit where the film just kind of wanders around for a bit and doesn't really know where it's going.
Yeah, so we get a few sort of important characters introduced. One is Kirkland, who is a kind of a tough blonde lady. She's basically our replacement for Callahan from the first film. That was her name. I looked it up. So Kirkland is, she's kind of young, blonde, tough, likes guns. She gets partnered with Tackleberry.
Yeah. And he is just like, holy shit, a woman with lots of guns. And he falls hard and fast for her. There's a bit where he has like a chat with Mahoney and he's talking about like, I think I'm in love with this woman because she basically just has a gun. And that's, you know me, I'm a psychopath. That's all I need. And then Mahoney is like, that's fantastic. You found like some sort of like crazy woman that you could maybe play saxophone with and shoot guns together. That's great.
That's when we get the immortal line where in the bar, just as the music stops, Tackleberry shouts, Mahoney, I'm a virgin.
Yeah, see, I get that's like the big comedy line. But the thing that was, I think, more telling about Tackleberry's character is that he goes into a bar and Mahoney goes like, a beer for me. It's like, oh, you drink milk with ice, right? Like, the obviously, like, he orders this enough that Mahoney knows it. But, like, to go into a pub and be like, I'll have, like, can I have some milk, please, but with some ice cubes in? That is...
I like a glass of milk, but, like, it's the insistence ice, the, upon ice, yeah.
I mean, and it's just another thing that goes to prove that Tackleberry is a fucking psychopath. That is that is the shit that serial killers do. Anyway, I like that. It was a little wrinkle on Tackleberry's character.
But yeah, so we sort of slowly throughout the course of this movie, we get the romance between Tackleberry and Kirkland play out, which we'll deal with a little bit later, I suppose.
Yeah.
The other big partnering that we get is with Gutenberger, who goes to get fitted for a nice new uniform. He gets paired with partner called Stuhlmann, who is kind of the exact opposite. He's not very classy. He's not very hygienic. He's a bit of a slob.
Yes.
He's always eating. There's a very funny scene where he's eating a bowl of cereal, which he then, partway through eating it, discovers that his cat has been using as a litter box. Keeps eating it, because, you know...
Yeah, that's another joke that doesn't land. Yeah, so he's kind of becomes like the kind of the sidekick to Mahoney in all of this. And then you just get a lot of like Mauser being kind of the second in command of the police station is just kind of really trying to give these new recruits a lot of shit.
Yeah.
Like he just, because he wants them to fail. And then every now and then the punk gang will show up and kind of harass people. So there's a big kind of, I guess it's a set piece, isn't it? Where there's like a big shootout in Sweet Chuck's Lamporium, where like some of the punks are hassling him for money. I don't know why these punks are really kind of like, that guy owns a lamp shop. He's got loads of money for us to shake him down. And like basically all the new recruits all show up like and they blow the place up basically. They just shoot the...
Well, they're inexperienced. So the joke is that they turn up one at a time and each new person that turns up thinks that the cops inside are the criminals. And so, but they're obviously terrible shots, so they miss each other and they're just, it's this never-ending firefight.
Yeah.
And it's poorly executed as a joke, because I shouldn't have to explain that to you. You literally just watched it. But like, yeah, it's badly done.
It is badly done, and it just gives, it doesn't really do anything. It just, it kind of, the only thing it kind of reveals is like, obviously like Mauser is like really frustrated, but... Lassard really takes a shine to Mahoney and like these new guys. Like Mahoney like tries to weasel out them being in trouble by being kind of like, well, all we were doing was going out there and doing our best. And if us doing our best is a crime, then I guess you should just lock all of us up. And then Lassard, being a complete fucking moron, just goes, you know what? You're right, Mahoney, as he wipes a tear from his eye, and Mauser just like looks around being like, what the fuck is going on? Which is kind of how I felt. I was with Mauser on this one, because it wasn't even like a funny scene where like Mahoney really outwits people, like he talks rings around them. He just says, he just does a bland speech.
Yeah, it's... And the maybe it's just the music, the quality of that rousing music that we
get underneath. Because again, the score in this one is really working overtime, because the actors are kind of working undertime. And this is like another very kind of like that poor man's Ferris Bueller kind of vibe. Like you could imagine that thing of, yeah, like someone talking riddles around the authority figure and getting out. And then at the end, the authority figure would be like, hey, what just happened? What did I do here? But it's just not, it's not even as clever as that.
No.
It's just badly written. We get another, I guess you want to call it a set piece, where Bobcat Goldthwait's gang go to the supermarket and they trash the supermarket and that's it.
Yeah, there's no jokes.
There's no jokes. It's basically Bobcat Goldthwait's going and like Sweet Chuck is there getting like harassed by the gang, and then we cut back to Bobcat going And this goes on for about like 3 or 4 minutes, and you go like, okay, cool. It's a big setup for a gag. Just another scene. Okay, fine.
It's just like they were improving it, and then after a while they realised there's not going to be any gags, are there? So we better just cut away.
Yes, that definitely feels like it was something where like, oh, we'll just go and shoot some stuff, and we'll just like really like free ball and just work some stuff out, and we'll just see what we've got, and we'll just edit it together. And like, you know, like Bobcat, he's great. He's just like this energetic young comedian. He's going to give us loads of stuff. And it's like, no, he's just shouted. We've got like 40 minutes of him shouting. Well, I guess we'll edit it down.
I'll tell you what does work a bit better is another little kind of comedy set piece around the shower room with...
Okay, yeah.
So Gutenberg comes in, and just I've got a note in my notebook that throughout this entire movie, Gutenberg has a lot of sadness in his eyes, even while he's kind of mugging for the camera and delivering sort of his... I suppose you'd call them jokes, but he's just got this kind of real kind of haunted look about him. And I'm thinking about it a lot, and I'm going to track that as the movies go on, I think. Had the sort of the hollowing
of
Gutenberg.
Until we get to one film, it's like, oh, he's not in it. That last one was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Because by the end of this one, I feel like behind the facade of his face, there's nothing left of him.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing.
But so he comes in like a haunted vase, like a china plate with an owl painted on it, like a treasure chest that's been looted and replaced with dead babies.
Shit.
Like a burning car with a nun inside.
He's all of those things and less.
And less. He comes in like Steve Gutenberg, basically.
Oh, yeah. So like sort of Steve Gutenberg now. Just kind of a little bit kind of just sad and yeah, whatever. Anyway, he comes shower in.
He comes in, and Tackleberry is in the shower room, and he's fixing his helmet with a kind of epoxy resin. And Gutenberg La goes, "What's that epoxy resin?" And Tackleberry goes, "It's epoxy resin." And he goes, "Cool, man, I love me some epoxy resin. How long does that epoxy resin take to set?" And he goes, "Oh, it'll turn to plastic in 2 seconds." And he goes, "And how long does that epoxy resin last?" And he goes, "A few years." And then Mauser gets into the shower. Mauser's showers.
And he sings a little song to himself, which is basically his evil plan. He's like, "In 30 days, Lassard's going to get kicked out. And then I'll be the captain. Ba-ba-da-bow. And then I'm going to be an asshole to all the new recruits. I'm going to fuck them up." It's kind of like, everyone can hear you.
One of the lines in his song that he sings is like, "And all the ladies will say, Yowza, Captain Mauser."
Yes.
Love that.
Yeah.
This scene works. And so the Glutes takes the epoxy resin and swaps it for Mauser's shampoo, which means that he glues his hands to his hair. It turns to plastic. He's stuck. But then he's got shampoo in his eyes. He can't work out what's going on. He's wandering around. Long story short, some people see his peen.
Boy, is his face red. And then, like, he has to, like... There are a few, like, nice little follow-up gags from this, because his kind of, like, his whipping boy in this, Proctor, who I think is another character that shows up in later films, like, he has to cut the hands off of his head, and then he's got these hairy palms. So there's, like, a load of, like, scenes where he's trying to do his, like, serious police business, now in a awful wig, but he's also, like... got these really hairy hands. He goes, "What should I do about this?" And shows his hands. And then, you know, like someone will say kind of like, "Well, if you carry on doing that, you'll probably go blind." so he's not entirely happy about that. We also get like a scene where Lassard again proves that he's a fucking loose cannon and does not know what he is doing as the chief of this precinct, where he just kind of like drives down an alleyway and just goes to start like a one-on-one fist fight with a gang member. He just like pulls, and like there's no build up to this. There's nothing to kind of like ease you into the scene. You just see him like pull up a car and get out and just be like, "Yeah, motherfucker, it's It's just you and me. Yeah, come on. Well, just you and me. Yo, Lasard's in the house and he's got some whoop ass for you. And then all of like the whole gang like of punks descend upon him and like spray paint him. And he's kind of like, he's a fucking loose cannon, this guy. He's that is not the actions that a chief of police should be taking.
I think he's desperate. I think that like he's, part of him knew that he would lose that fight. He wanted to lose.
He did. Yeah, he's a desperate man because we then see him like having like a real heart to heart with his big brother Lasard, where they go to. This was actually one of the, like, the other scenes that actually kind of made me chuckle, where they go to like a Japanese teppanyaki bar.
This is the one where the guy's got like all the knives on the hot grill, right?
Yeah, where you sit around a hot grill and the guys are like going. Bang, 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 bang. And all the jokes basically come from, like, they're just two people trying to have a normal conversation. And then you've got this guy just going. And he's like, can you stop doing that? And then the guy will just be kind of like. Ooh. And then he'll get some salt out and go. And, I mean, I don't know if it says, it must say something about, like, the jokes written in this film. That one of the scenes I found funniest was just a very accurate portrayal of eating in a teppanyaki bar. Like, it's not... There was nothing kind of, like, out of the ordinary. If you've eaten at one of those restaurants, that is exactly what goes on screen. Like, it's not, like, played for... It's just...
I'll tell you what was played for laughs is that Lasard, the older... Our boy from the first film, he turns up with his goldfish in a bowl that he takes with him everywhere now, apparently. That's his
thing. Oh, no, that's a present for his brother.
Oh, it's a present for his brother.
Because he loves goldfish, apparently. Because earlier on you saw him, I think he just kills a lot of goldfish because he killed a goldfish earlier in the film.
Right, yeah. But then he accidentally pops this goldfish in a bowl on the hot grill table that they're sat at and it kind of slowly boils throughout their conversation.
Yeah, I feel that this goldfish thing is going to be a bit of a through line for like... a lot of the other films. Like, I don't know, he's just got a goldfish fetish.
Speaking of through lines through the films, you know what else returned that was in the previous film?
Yeah.
The Blue Oyster Bar, that incredibly sensitively portrayed gay bar from the first film.
Yeah.
Where I believe Sweet Chuck, who at this point has a broken arm that's kind of set like out of at a right angle from his body in a cast, he's trying to run from the gang and he runs into the Blue Oyster Bar in the middle of the day and there's a big banner up. Oh no, it's their tango competition day. Because his arm is out of this side, one of these incredibly predatory gay gentlemen in like leather chaps just like grabs him and forcibly takes him into an aggressive tango.
And then the gang all walk in and for some reason they don't tango, they just then instantly have a fight with all these kind of like big kind of like very like you know, like in The Village People, the biker, that it's that kind of look dudes.
Yeah, but like Dunn is clearly like stick on mustaches.
Yeah. And then it was nice. I don't know why it was just it was just funny seeing the Blue Oyster Bar appear, seeing as we were kind of like, fucking hell, this is ridiculous.
Everything to do a callback to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, oh God, I wonder if they're going to keep on coming back to that. And then there was another thing that I think is going to be a theme through some of these other films is Michael Winslow's kung fu shtick. So he has a fight with these two punks who are trying to rob this like Asian greengrocer. And he kind of like puts on like a Karate Kid bandana and he makes lots of kind of like kung fu movie, kind of like those like really big kind of like noises. And he kind of talks like he's being badly dubbed. I'm sure this was all fucking hilarious back in 1985, but it just, I don't know, like his shit just is not landing. And I think the thing that then makes it kind of worse is they've dubbed the Asian greengrocer, which I think is meant to be a bit of like a side gag to this whole scene. And it's a bit like in Wayne's World, where Wayne meets his girlfriend's dad, and it's like, I'm an Asian man, and I'm being dubbed like in like a Western adaptation of a kung fu film. In Wayne's World, it's funny and it's done quite well. And the guy has this very deep kind of like cool baritone voice. In this, they've just dubbed the Asian actor with like a really kind of like offensive Asian stereotype voice. It's not nice.
It's not good.
Yeah. And so you're pairing that with just Winslow just doing some fucking shit. That's not a funny scene. And there's like another Winslow scene in this where his partner that he gets is a dickhead. They're driving in the car and Winslow makes the sound of like a flat tire. And the guy goes, "Oh, we got a flat tire. I'm going to have to get out and check the car." So this again, there's the whole Winslow, no one knows about the direction of sound. That's for one, why this gag does not work. For two, if you have a flat tire in your car, you fucking know it.
Testify, Tom.
Fuck off, Winnow.
Yeah, and then, but the point of this scene, the reason the scene is so shit is that they then get out of the car, check, go, no flat tires, and they get back in the car, drive off. That's it. No resolution, no punchline.
Like a lot of the gags in this, there's no resolution or punchline. It's just like a very awkward edit to the next scene. One of the things maybe we should talk about before we get into like the third act is Tackleberry's romance.
Yes, his date. So we get this nice section of him kind of like dolling himself up for a date with his partner, Kirkland. He's got this like really amazing like golf suit on that's like all sort of tartan instead of cologne. He's putting on gun oil,
yeah,
you know, all of this classic stuff. And he turns up at Kirkland's house and is amazed to see her in a dress, you know. And they go out to some sort of restaurant, I suppose.
Yeah, they go somewhere and they go dance and they dance until the place closes and all of that. And they go back to her place and she just like turns and goes, "Tackleberry, I love you." First date. Whoa. And he's like, "Me too," because this film is only like 90 minutes long. We do not have time to eke this out.
I believe this is the first date he's ever been on from the sounds of it. But...
yeah. And then they get down to it pretty quickly. They like get into bed and like you've got this this gag where she's unstrapping all the guns that are, like, attached to, you know, like, you've got one on his leg and all these ones, like, strapped to his side and stuff like that. And it's like, I'm like, huh, it's funny because Tackleberry's a psychopath. That's the gag. And then the lights go out completely black, you know, like, she's taken off all the guns, she's taken off all of his clothes, lights go out, bang! And she goes like, "Oh, Eugene! He had a gun strapped to his dick."
Well, I wasn't sure if that was... I mean, it's yes, he did have a gun strapped to his dick, I guess. I thought that that was a premature ejaculation joke, Tom.
That might have also been a premature ejaculation joke, coupled with the fact that he...
Had a gun strapped to his dick!
I know it doesn't seem that funny,
guess
folks.
He needs to shoot anyone in the hoo-hoo!
We've just watched this film and we were really just scratching for anything that just, like... raised like a little, just a murmur of laughter.
Only thing I can think of funnier than dick is a dick with a gun strapped to it.
Really speaks to Tackleberry's character. Although something that didn't speak to Tackleberry's character is he goes and meets Kirkland's parents, and there's this whole gag where like her dad is like really competitive with her brother, who's like a boxer, and the dad used to be a boxer, and they just spend the whole time just like punching each other in the face in the living room. And Tackleberry's there going like, "These people are insane. This is bizarre behavior. This is overly violent for no reason." It's like, but we just saw you at the beginning of the film fire like a fucking tear gas thing into a car with a small child in it. They lost sight of Tackleberry's character there.
While he's meeting his girlfriend's parents, does he have a gun strapped to his dick?
I imagine that he always has a gun strapped to his dick.
I have a follow-up question for you, Tom. This is a question for you specifically.
Yeah.
Would you rather get into a fight with Tackleberry or Hightower?
Hightower. Because obviously he'll fuck you up, but there's never been any indication that Hightower is... going to murder you.
I'd go with Hightower too, because I feel like you could reason with him.
Yeah, I think he's kind of a gentle soul deep down, so I don't think he will use excessive force, whereas Tackleberry will always use excessive force.
He only knows how. Okay, yeah. And supplementary question. If you only had one punch to land, is one free punch, Gutenberg or Winslow?
I think it might be Winslow.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm with you.
Also, Gutenberg is annoying as fuck, but I do like Two Men and a Little Baby. So Winslow hasn't done that. So that's a strike against him.
Winslow was in Spaceballs, and I do love Spaceballs.
I do love Spaceballs, but he just does the same shit in... His shtick works better in Spaceballs. I think maybe because in that he's almost explaining it. You know, like, because he's like, we've lost the beeps, the sweeps, and the creeps. Yeah, and like, he's kind of like, this is my gag. I'm going to explain it to you. Isn't that funny? Rather than you just being sitting there, but he's just sat right next to him. You would know that that's not the sound of you eating.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
It just doesn't make sense.
Speaking of things that don't make any sense, Tom. The final third of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
The dramatic third act.
So, to quickly rush through this, Lasard Sr. tells Lasard Jr. at the Teppanyaki restaurant that what they should do to improve their relations with the public is to have a police fair, which is basically like having like a fair, a carnival kind of thing, but for some reason all the police are running it rather than carnies, and it's to improve local relations. And we get to see the Lady Mayor.
She doesn't get many lines, but she's in it. She seems all right.
But Zed's gang show up and they trash the joint. Zed has a bit where he goes up to the Lady Mayor and shakes her hand and goes like, I voted for you. And she goes, oh, well, that was very nice. Cut. Savage cut. Back to Mauser and the gang. Lasard Jr. quits. He's like, fuck this, Mahoney. He's out. Mauser is like, now I'm in charge. I'm going to fuck you all up unless someone tells me who glued my hands to my head and made me show my peen to a bunch of people. Mahoney's like, it was me, because he's like taking one for the tip. Well, he did do it, but he doesn't want everyone else to get fucked over. His partner, the gross slob, kind of like was like, you can't get rid of Mahoney. You got to get rid of me. And he's like, well, I'm going to get rid of you. So then Lasard Jr., Mahoney, and Slob Cop try and, like, they send Mahoney undercover into Zed's gang. And this is where the film turns a corner, in my opinion, because this is the bit where suddenly you're like, oh, fuck, Gutenberg is actually quite watchable when he goes undercover and he's meant to be a crazy punk.
Yeah, this is like 15 minutes from the end of the film, but it doesn't take him... He's apparently the most talented undercover cop of all time, because he ingratiates himself with Zed's gang incredibly quickly. He has a fake tash on and a hat and a leather jacket, and he waits until some bad-looking dudes walk past, and then he runs out in front of them and goes... and smashes a phone box.
It's
and,
what Zed likes.
And these guys come up to him and go, be like... Hey, man, you seem pretty cool.
Yeah. What's your name? He goes like, Jughead. It's like, what gang are you in? The Archies. Nice. Okay. Nice. Like that. little Archie gag there.
And they go, we're with the Stallions. And he's like, how can I be a Scallion? And they go, no, it's the Stallions. We've got to take you to go see Zed. So long story short, some stuff happens, but then he goes to go see Zed, basically. And he's undercover, he's all mic'd up, and the cops are like, you got to tell us where you are. You got to give us clues in the mic so we can find out where you are. And he's walking around going, this sure is a nice cave you've got me in. And he goes and meets Zed, and they got him there. He's in this big cave. He figures out it's the old zoo. He says into his mic, ah, the old zoo. And so all the cops know he's in the old zoo. They're on their way. But then there's some like feedback, and his radio mic starts to pick up a baseball game. Bobcat Goldthwait, aka Zed, goes, you were in the wire! And then they figure out he's a cop and all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, so then like the rest of the gang kind of go and storm the joint while Mahoney and Zed are having one of those like knife fights, like in the Michael Jackson Beat It video, where they kind of, you know, where you like lash two guys, lash their hands, their hands together, and they're having like a knife fight where they're tied together.
Oh yeah.
Which is, and you're kind of like, ooh, like this, it's quite jarring after just like the film just kind of wandering around like a disorientated sort of like person who's like very heavily sedated and doesn't really know where they are, just kind of wandering around in their dressing gown, just in a supermarket, just going like, do I live here? Is this me? To then suddenly just kind of like, stakes, peril, character arcs. Fuck, we've like only 15 minutes from the end. It's
still no fucking jokes.
Well, no, it's like the last film that like when stakes are involved, there's no jokes, because there weren't really a lot of jokes in the riot at the end of the last one.
True.
And that is
we
still...
We only watched the last one last week, and I cannot fucking remember it at all.
No. And hopefully we won't remember much of this one soon either. A sweet, sweet ignorance will kind of sweep over us. But then they just kind of go in, and there's nothing really.
They storm the place. They arrest all the gang members. Hightower is tough.
Winslow does exactly the same thing that he did in the last one. So in the last one, the riot, this police car is being swamped by, like, you know, like they're completely outnumbered. So he gets a microphone and makes gun sounds. He does exactly the same thing in this. There's like loads of this gang around, and he gets a megaphone and just goes, you know, like makes all this, and it's like, you did that, and it's not funny.
It's not funny.
And also the other thing is, it seems to have absolutely no effect on any of the gang. They all still just run around doing literally, you know, like it's not like they all go, shit guys, it's the cops, we gotta go. It all just plays out like everyone is just kind of like, who's this dickhead over here with the megaphone just like making a load of noises? Oh, just ignore him. He did this last time.
Yeah. And then they win him over. The younger Lestrade brother decides to rejoin the force, and apparently brings back Mahoney and Slobkop, I guess.
Yeah, they're all back. And then they go to Tackleberry's wedding.
Tackleberry and Kirkland's wedding, which is kind of a nice style wedding, kind of a bit more traditional than you'd expect.
Yeah.
Until... they come out of the church and into a fucking monster truck.
Yeah, and instead of tin cans, like, tied to the back, they're, like beer kegs or something like that. You know, like, they're...
it's just a big thing. I don't know. It's unclear what they are.
Yeah, and they get in the monster truck. They drive around the corner. Fucking hard cut to the credits.
Bam! Credits! Everybody out! We've got to get everyone in for the next showing.
Yeah. It... just... you expect, like a slight... slightly softer ease out, you know, like maybe a nice little freeze frame of all the guys stood together laughing, enjoying each other's company, but they have absolutely no time to fuck around with this. They're just like, done.
I have a question for you, Tom.
Yeah.
Do you think that Kirkland, aka Mrs. Tackleberry, is going to be in the next film?
I don't know, man, because you would hope so. There was a load of people who didn't show up in...
we didn't get Barbara this time.
Yeah, Barbara, George Martin.
George Martin, Callahan.
Yeah.
Obviously Harris.
Harris. The two, like Harris's two stooges. Yeah, there's a bunch of people who just didn't show up. And it would be nice for continuity if like Tackleberry's wife kind of shows up. But at the same time, she didn't have... jokes, you know, she didn't have she was there to provide an arc for Tackleberry, like where she wasn't like introduced like, oh, she's like going to be like a really strong member of the cast, the police academy gang, in her own right, because they've already got one gun nutcase, which is Tackleberry.
Yeah,
they're not very good at like handling like the sort of like the female characters, that they just kind of...
I'm predicting that if they do bring her back, it will be that they've had a baby and then she's not a cop anymore. Obviously, because you can either be, yeah, you know, once you become someone's wife in these movies, then that's it. Like, that's who you are now. Yeah. So she's going to be mumming out, and there's going to be some jokes about them having like a baby that plays with grenades or something.
Okay,
like that.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. Be a bit like Adam's Family Values or something. They've just got like a baby like cradling like a massive magnum or something like that.
That's going to be the joke.
Yeah, because, yeah, like, Hooks did nothing in this. She like, her gag in this was basically the same gag she had at the end of the last one, that she... In the last one, she pulled the gun on Sexy Grandpa and said, "Freeze, dirtbag!" And she does exactly the same thing in this one with Zed, but it's... Like, that was a good moment for Hooks' character, but it wasn't like a fucking, like, you know, like a thigh-slappingly good... Like, oh, fucking hell, that was hilarious. It was...
Mm.
So it doesn't have the same impact this time round. Like, it wasn't really a joke last time. It was more of a completing of an arc. Very small arcs that they have in this.
Yeah. That does kind of sum up the movie, I suppose. It's just a lot of little kind of mini, tiny micro arcs.
Yeah, with just a lot of filler in the middle of what is, I guess, was considered jokes, but I don't know, this one hasn't really sat well with me.
I guess they rushed it out. It was a year, right? They had a year from the first one to the second one. So I'm feeling more confident about the third one, which is it back in training?
It's back in training. So I'm imagining it's going to be a bit of a reset. We're going to get Harris back. We're going to get more of Lassard Senior.
I tell you what,
probably some new recruits, like, because there wasn't a lot of new characters. I don't know. We might get some more. Well, I think we're going to get the return of like Zed and Sweet Chuck.
Zed and Sweet Chuck will be cool. I'm going to miss, if he's not in it, Mauser as the heel. From this one, if he doesn't come back, I don't see how they can write him back. I think the Mauser's maybe a bit better than Harris, even.
I don't know. I do like Harris. Because
you like the way he goes, "Move it, move it, move it!"
Of course I like that. Yeah. So, you know that you're like saying like maybe this one suffered because they rushed it out.
Oh, yeah.
So it was like 84, 85. The next one was made in 86. Yeah, and it's by the same director. I don't know if it's by the same writer. I don't think it's the same writers. So hopefully it's more the fault of the writers than the director.
That would be nice.
But we'll see. I mean, the writers of this, I think, did Moving to America.
Do you mean Coming to America?
Coming to America.
The John Landis movie.
Yeah, they did that, but then they also did The Nutty Professor and The Clumps.
I think it's bad enough to have done The Nutty Professor.
Yeah.
But to then come back and throw the fucking Clumps at us.
Yeah. But anyway, we don't have to deal with them anymore for like the next film. So let's hope we're going to get like a little upturn, maybe.
A little uptick.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, until then, thank you very much for coming on this most Police Academy-ish ride with us.
It can only get more Academy-ish from here on in.
Yeah. If you'd like to drop us a line, you can always reach us on Twitter at Bitter End Pod or on Facebook at Bitter End Pod. We always try to reply and it's always great to hear from you guys. Don't forget, we've got 5 other complete seasons than this beforehand, dealing with Friday the 13th, Highlander, The Howling, Universal Soldier, and A Nightmare on Elm Street. So if you are a new listener, do dive into that back catalogue while you're waiting for the next episode, by all means.
Mm-hmm.
And my name is Todd Jordan.
My name is Tom Denny. And we'll see you next week when we will be back in training.
Thank you very much.